Welcome to the SDF conferencing system. There are two other parties in this conference.
We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
That's right. Sorry, just checking my volume levels here. Making sure I'm coming through okay. What are we going to talk about today? I thought I would talk just a little bit about macroeconomics, which is possibly a very boring subject, but I had this bouncing around in my head for a while, and I want to try it out on you. Now, something I've been trying to get my hands on, and so far without a lot of success, is some of Frederick Soddy's writings on economics. Frederick Soddy, if you don't know the name, was Ernest Rutherford's coadjutor. He was deeply involved in the discovery of the nucleus and of nuclear reactions. You know, some of the key work which, of course, then led to the discovery of artificial radioactivity and ultimately of the fission chain reaction. And in the 1930s, when everybody was concerned about economics because it was breaking pretty badly, he was talking about something he called Cartesian economics, which, despite the name, does not refer to something with a high order of mathematical abstraction far removed from the planes of human life. Quite the opposite. So Soddy's idea of Cartesian economics was to go back to basic principles, things like people need to eat, people need to sleep under shelter, that kind of thing. And also to recognize that we borrow money to build things, and the things that we build require constant renewal to keep them in operating condition. Right, or they just waste away with time, whereas debts don't necessarily, which doesn't make a lot of sense, that we've created a financial structure which is massively detached from the way that the world that it's supposed to reflect behaves. And of course, as I've said many a time, you can confirm this for yourself by leafing through the average day's issue of the Wall Street Journal. Financial Times tends to be a little bit better about this, I'm not sure why. Anyway, I'm not certain whether Soddy's Cartesian economics is any good or whether he's just as much of a nut as lots and lots of other people who were talking about economics in the late 20s and early 30s. So I'm hoping to get hold of some of his writings to find out. I don't necessarily believe that just because someone is good in one field of science, one field of human activity, that he will necessarily have anything useful to say in another field. But on the other hand, if you ever pick up Sir Fred Hoyle's book, A Decade of Decision, I've got a copy of it. I might be persuaded to lend it out. He begins the book with the observation that whenever technical and scientific people like him venture an opinion about political and economic topics, they are dismissed with the statement, well, you don't really understand the complexities of these kinds of things. To which his response is, well, you who do pretend to understand these complexities haven't done very well at all, have you? He was writing in 1952. Not that long after the end of a little unpleasantness some people know as the Second World War, which was caused almost entirely by the failure of politicians and economists to assimilate the lessons of the First World War. So, as you can imagine, he felt that these people were claiming a little too much for themselves, and I think he had a good reason to do so. But But with that in mind, I'm going to indulge in the spot of amateur macroeconomic analysis, because I'm going to talk about Venezuela. Actually, I had a question in Calm last week about Venezuela, and I have some fairly trenchant remarks to make about Venezuela. Some people say, oh, well, everything that's wrong with Venezuela is the fault of Hugo Chavez. And some people say, oh, well, everything that's wrong with Venezuela is the fault of the United States for trying to overthrow Chavez. And no. No, my friends. The fault of Venezuela, the fault is not in ourselves, but in our stars. The fault of Venezuela is a combination of circumstances which is, I want to be clear, not at all rare. Venezuela represents a case of a single crop export economy. And as it turns out, single crop export economies are always, always ugly. So in Venezuela, the way we can model it is this. There are two economic spheres. There is the dollar economy and the Bolivar economy. In the dollar economy, oil is sold overseas and dollars come in. Dollars are then sent out again to buy finished goods, which are imported. Venezuela doesn't have paper mills, doesn't have breweries, doesn't have creameries. You want toilet paper or newsprint, you want beer, you want butter, you have to import them from some other country. That's not something Chavez did. That's the way it's been in Venezuela for generations. Then there's the Bolivar economy. When the dollars come in, a certain number of Bolivars is released into the local economy as a proxy. And some people get Bolivars, and some people don't get Bolivars. And the people who get Bolivars essentially use them to choose what things the dollars get spent on. And that's about it. Now, when Chavez came to power, he announced something called Bolivarian Socialism. And the only thing socialist about it, essentially, was that he changed where the Bolivars were going. You know, expropriating the oil companies, blah, blah, blah. Essentially, the only change that was made was a change in where the Bolivars went. So a different group of people was choosing what the dollars got spent on. But it didn't alter the macroeconomics of Venezuela at all. It was still a case of oil goes out, dollars come in. Dollars go out, finished goods come in. Now, Chavez did screw up some things royally. For instance, a lot of people in the oil business were not really happy with Chavez, and they took to political activity opposed to him. And he didn't like that at all, so he blacklisted a bunch of people who worked in the oil industry. Well, you can guess what the natural outcome of that was, can't you? The efficiency of oil production in Venezuela, in terms, for example, of barrels of oil produced per bolivar, right, of local labor costs, per dollar of overseas labor costs, overseas material costs, well, that efficiency went down. That's a bit of a problem, because it means fewer dollars available per bolivar in the national economy. In other words, inflation, depreciation, shortages of goods. Eventually, right? And then something else happened, which could not have been foreseen per se, but which should not have come as a surprise, because these kinds of things are always happening in the oil business. Firstly, you had the economic depression following on the bank panic of 2008, which temporarily lowered world demand for oil. And then about the same time, you had the United States introducing hydrofracking and producing large amounts of gas and light oils. And this is a key consideration because Venezuela produces heavy oils. Heavy oils fetch a much lower price in the world market than light oils do. Basically, Right up until the point where it's no longer a liquid at room temperature, the higher proportion of hydrogen in your hydrocarbon, the more valuable it is in the world market. People talk about the hydrogen economy without quite realizing the hydrogen economy exists now. It's just mostly based on hydrogen that's being extracted from the ground accompanied by carbon. The job of the carbon in hydrocarbons is simply to keep the hydrogen liquid at room temperature. That's pretty much all it does. Nobody really wants long-chain, heavy hydrocarbons except for paving roads with. They're used in ship propulsion and so on because they're cheap, because they're essentially a waste product when compared with the higher hydrogen fraction substances. Now, your smart oil people who have gas, which is less valuable because it's not liquid at room temperature, and heavy oils, will take those two products and combine them in a refinery to make a light oil, which has a much higher value in the world market. But that is all by the way. The fact is that Venezuela, already a significant fraction of its production, is so heavy that OPEC doesn't actually classify it as oil, which means that there is a significant variation between OPEC production statistics and Venezuelan production statistics. It makes for some interesting footnotes in the BP World Energy Outlook, I tell you that. So yes, Venezuela has low-value oil and is getting worse and worse every year at producing it. Now, honestly, this wouldn't have made much of a difference in Venezuela's overall economic prospects if Chavez had done interesting things. Say, for example, taking that dollar income and instead of simply issuing a certain number of bolivars to the poorer people in the country to let them, instead of the wealthy people, pick what goods got imported this time around, used it to build factories, right? Again, paper mills, creameries, right? Breweries. Because Venezuela has excellent agricultural land. If you look at their coins, the bolivar coins, they have the Venezuelan coat of arms on it. And one of the things on there is a sheaf of wheat, because it is a very productive country agriculturally. But in order to make anything out of that, you've got to have, at the absolute minimum, you should have things like tractors. And making one step further from that, it's a real good idea to have breweries and creameries, flour mills, and all those kinds of things. Because otherwise, even if you are producing agricultural products, such as grain or milk, you're shipping them abroad, say to Colombia, whatever the nearest country is, it's Colombia or Guyana, really, and then you're re-importing what you just produced at a significantly higher price. Remember what I said about value added when I was talking about Chile and manufacturing based on copper. So if Chavez had redirected some of that income into buying abroad the components needed to set up factories for producing things, and then employing the poorer people in Venezuela in those factories and in agriculture, which would gradually be raising in value as the local capacity for generating value-added products increased, right? Because, of course, the prices of things like butter and beer are relatively high in Venezuela if they're being imported. So, if you're producing them locally, then you can afford to charge a fairly high price and still be competitive, which means that the people working in the brewery and the people working in the creamery and the people working in the farms and the dairies all have some wiggle room to be paid more, right? That would not be a bad interpretation of socialism for a country like Venezuela. Is that what he did? No. What factories did he build? A factory to make AK-47s. Exactly what his country needed, guns, so that when the economic situation finally deteriorated enough, it would be really easy to break out into large-scale violence. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of Hugo Chavez, not because of his socialism, but because of his stupidity. You know, guy get on... The last thing I want to, you know, I don't want to live in a country where some guy dressed in army green gets on the TV every weekend and makes a 4-hour long speech You know, that is not the kind of country where you can expect good things to happen. And Hugo Chavez, when in control of Venezuela, was just the embodiment of that. And the whole thing fills me with disgust, because he had the opportunity to take the country in a genuine new direction, a new direction which would build things, which would make the country less dependent on import revenue, and thus less dependent on the oil sector, and also because there would be jobs outside the oil sector for people with technical skills and education, would also make it easier to develop those kinds of skills, meaning that work on the oil sector wouldn't be the only technically complex thing, and people would be more likely to get that kind of education and training because they would have plenty of different jobs they could do, and so there would be a larger reserve of people to work in the oil sector when it was needed. Doesn't that seem like a grand plan? Yeah. People are really short-sighted a lot of the time, and that's one of the things that I like least about them. I realize that this is not a show for the purpose of me complaining about the inadequacies of the human race, but we're going to touch on that sometimes, right? Because the whole point of this program, in a sense, is that in the fall of 1944, spring of 1945, right, in the period roughly from July of 44 to July, let's even say June of 44 to August of 45, right in that period, right? And it's not even the first half, not even the second half of August 1945, just the first week, 2 weeks, right? First 2 weeks of August of 45. Two entirely new things appear upon the world scene. The high-speed rocket and the fission chain reaction. And the way they appear is the most terrible way they could possibly appear, raining down death and destruction upon cities. And the people who invented these two things, who brought them to life in the world, that's not what they wanted them for. You know, as I've probably mentioned, Wernher von Braun was actually arrested by the Gestapo for sabotaging the German war effort, because when the first V2 successfully hit its target, he turned to the person standing next to him and said, "Well, it works. Too bad it landed on the wrong planet." Because he had no interest in destroying all the wonderful things that humanity has constructed on this earth? Absolutely not. He was, however, a completely amoral mercenary who would take anybody's money as long as it got closer to his goal. Amoral isn't even the word. TV Tropes describes it as green and purple or green and orange morality. It's just he had a moral compass which was pointed in a direction completely unfamiliar to most human beings. You know, and the people who brought fission energy to life in the world, you know, they were thinking, they were planning, even during the war, right? They were planning how to apply this great new force for everyone's benefit. Everything from greatly reducing the cost of large-scale excavations using nuclear explosives to generating massive amounts of power in forms that would be suitable not only for central station electric generation, but also for propelling ships and things like that. Matter of fact, you may not realize this, but about 1960, the United States got within a few months of flying a nuclear-powered airplane, which is kind of scary, but it would have worked. The HTRE-3 was considered to be the basis of a flight-capable nuclear-heated jet engine, in which compressor, you know, it's just like a normal jet engine, except instead of the air passing through a combustion chamber, it passes through the core of a working nuclear reactor, which sounds kind of scary, but it also does actually work. Similarly, the United States came within a very short distance. I mean, we built the rockets, we just never flew them, of having nuclear-powered interplanetary or cislunar rocket propulsion for moving people between Earth orbit and lunar orbit and back, for example, or for sending people to Mars. But the point here is two very important new things appeared in the world, two things that essentially changed the texture, changed the fabric of human existence. One is the high-speed rocket. With a high-speed rocket, we are no longer chained to this planet. The entire cosmos is our scope. And the other is the nuclear fission chain reaction, which gives us power over the intranuclear strong force, right? Gravitation is the weakest and largest scale of the fundamental forces of physics. The intranuclear strong force is the strongest, as its name implies, and shortest range of the fundamental forces of modern physics. And humanity became notified within a space of less than 16 months that control had been achieved over both those things, and we became notified of it in the absolute worst possible manner. Again, as I say, thunderbolts of Indra coming down in the most destructive fashion. And it was at that point that we were faced with a choice. The war, such as it was, that was raging at that time, ground to a halt. And there was a choice to be made. And the choice that was made then was not a good one. And the choices that we have continued to make are not good ones. Have we harnessed the nuclear fission chain reaction for the benefit of the world's peoples? Well, yes, but. Have we gone into space? Have we explored the planets? Have we begun to tap the mineral resources of the asteroid belt, for example, so that we no longer have to obtain those substances in an ecologically damaging way from the crust of the Earth? Well, we're working on it, kinda. Look at the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles which are poised at any moment to rain down death and destruction upon the cities of the world, to obliterate our civilization, to wipe out all the things that generation upon generation of people have spent their efforts, have invested their very heart and soul into creating, destroying not only people's lives, but everything that people have spent their lives for, all the tangible beauty, all the intangible beauty, right? It's like the destruction of the Flemish churches by the German artillery in the First World War, which was done for no reason other than to wipe out a part of the cultural heritage of mankind. It was one of the most extraordinary acts of brutality, pointless brutality, that could be imagined then. And we are talking about a period, to be perfectly frank, when genocide was never off the table. People, there's a lot of controversy raging now about the return of stolen, seized, lots of different words going around, African and Asian artifacts from European collections to the countries where they originally came from. And it's a sobering thought. You know, it reminds me, even when the British sent a punitive expedition against China in the middle of the 19th century and destroyed the Winter Palace, I believe it was the Winter Palace of the Chinese emperors, the commander of that expedition had a photographic crew along with him. They made careful measurements and took photographs and made every effort that they could to preserve the cultural value of the thing they were about to destroy. And even, you know, even people who were committing active genocide in the 19th century had this idea that they had better preserve the culture of the very people they were wiping out because it was of some value to the world. It's a very strange mindset. It's not one that I'm recommending to you, and it's not one that I'm trying to get too far into because I don't think I want my brain to work like that. But in the 20th century, we had instead a series of orgies of destruction. And as I say, the destruction of the Flemish churches by German artillery was a grand example of this. A lot of destruction in Russia by the Bolsheviks. Honestly, I would trace it back to the way that the Jacobins destroyed things in France in the early 1790s. You know, they melted down, for example, the Saint-Ampoule,
the vessel supposedly of holy oil brought down from heaven for the coronation of King Saint-Denis, for the coronation of the first king of France, the coronation by Archbishop Saint-Denis of Clothair? Childeric? Merovingian kings always get to me. It's that Merovingian corner of New Mexico. You know, Clovis, Clothair, Childeric, all those little towns next to each other. That's a really terrible joke. And I think only one person listening to this broadcast will get it. But that's not important. Well, they melted down things out of pure spite that people would have paid them 100 times the gold value or silver value or brass value of. I mean, they melted down the church bells to make minor coins. They melted, you know, because, yes, France was short of money, but they could have sold all these things for much more than that. They wanted to destroy, to wipe out the pre-existing culture, believing that the culture that they possessed up to then was no good whatsoever. And I'm still not sure if they were right or wrong. Right? Think about that for a minute, because if all the culture that has come down to the present day, all the things that we have built, all the words that we have written and recorded to be remembered by people literally thousands of years later, in the case of Caesar's commentaries or, God help us, the Chinese oracle bone scripts, right? If all of that massive culture has brought us to this point where we cannot think of a better thing to do with the high-speed rocket than use it, than point it to somebody else, if we cannot think of a better thing to do with the nuclear chain reaction, the fission chain reaction, than use it to build explosives and put them on the tips of those rockets and point it at somebody, in order to gain what? What is there to be gained on this little planet of ours, which is even vaguely comparable with the things which can be gained in the solar system? What is there to be gained by destruction, which is even vaguely comparable here on Earth, to using those same energies, and I mean energies in both the literal and the figurative sense, right? The creative energies of mankind, the intellectual energies of mankind, and the very literal energy of the fission chain reaction and of the fusion reaction. What is there to be gained by destruction that is even remotely comparable with what there is to be gained by construction? This is why I speak of two diverging paths. And one path leads down. The left-hand path leads downward to oblivion. The right-hand path leads upward to the stars. And here on Earth, we continue to stand mucking about. There's a Buddhist saying, not to choose is itself a choice. For literally generations now, since that year, 1944-45, we collectively on this planet have been pretending that we are not faced with a choice, that we can just sort of muck along in the old familiar way, and everything will be okay, I guess. It's not that it matters that much, does it? Yes. Everything there is that matters lies before us. Will we continue to be human beings? And will we exercise the scope of our intellectual and physical powers? Or will we make of ourselves something subhuman, something that rejects the higher parts of ourselves, embraces the lower, and ultimately embraces only destruction, something that ends in ash? Which of those two choices will we make? I am not an apocalypticist. I want to make that very clear, right? I am not someone who's preaching the end of the world. I'm not someone who's saying, oh, the end is coming, the doom is near. No, that's a stupid thing. I have no use for prophets of doom. Because doom implies fate, implies the lack of a choice. That is exactly the opposite of what stands before us now. We are presented with the choice which, oddly enough, in H.G. Wells, the movie version of H.G. Wells' The Shape of Things to Come, which is just called Things to Come, the entire universe or nothing.
As always, I'll end by remarking that if you so choose, you can support these broadcasts by sending me some money, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, and that you have no choice but to continue listening to the Dubious Goals Committee, which begins in 5 seconds.
7.